want to say something about this, the idea of a zero-sum game. The idea here was whether you made money or lost money on your option position, the other party was in exactly the opposite position. So they made money or lost money. So when you added up the gains and losses across the two parties, they were zero. Now, if I were more realistic and I considered brokers, then what happens when you add up the gains and losses across the buyer and seller of an option? It's negative. And then, if I consider the U.S. government, who's often a party to these transactions in the form of taxation, sometimes you can set it up so the U.S. government is negative and everybody else is on average positive. The general rule would be that the derivatives market is a zero-sum game. So one side wins, the other side essentially loses. That means that when you buy a call option, someone else is going to be selling that to you, and if you have a good reason to buy it, you should always ask yourself, why is that other dumb person selling it to me? Is it because I'm so smart and they're so dumb? Or is it because they know something I don't? Or it could be, it's not a question of having information, it just maybe that you prefer the pattern of returns because of your preferences. Just like you might, one person might prefer apples, another one might prefer oranges. You prefer the pattern of returns that you get by buying, and someone else prefers the pattern of returns he gets by selling. That's possible too. But because of the zero-sum nature of the game, in dollar terms, I think it's a very good idea to always ask yourself, why is the other party involved in this? Now, there's a tendency for people to say, well, I'm pretty smart, and the other guy is probably not as smart as I am, and that's probably why he's selling it. Then the text reminds you about one thing about human nature. It turns out that the average individual thinks that he's smarter than average. And that gives me pause to think. A typical person, in other words, is sort of programmed to think that he's smarter than average. Of course, the average person cannot be smarter than average. He has to be average. So people, I think, are psychologically biased. That's one of the propositions that's now being investigated in what we call behavioral finance, a relatively new area of research in finance where people are actually willing to say, hey, people may not be as rational as we thought. Let's see if we can figure out ways in which they depart from pure rationality, and then see if we can identify those ways and then see what effect those will have on security prices or the positions people will hold. I saw a gender-based study, actually the first gender-based study I've seen in financial economics. It claims that women make more money in the markets, this is for small investors, than men. How do they know this? Well, this fellow has thousands of accounts from an unspecified discount broker, and the people are identified by gender, and he's able to watch how they do. Why is it that women do better than men? Well, it turns out that men trade more, and trading turns out to be bad, because the more you trade on average in this sample, the less well you do, because you end up paying, more trading costs, and you don't know what you're doing anyway. You may think you're smarter than average, but you're not. Women, on the other hand, don't trade as much. The psychological implication is that men are more aggressive. Women are a little more laid back, is the idea. They're not trying to prove anything, whereas the man has to prove something by trading back and forth, you see. That's not proven, that interpretation, but you could argue that.
I have a question on that.
Yes.
Brad, I bought that call. Didn't pay to exercise it.
I'm glad I sold the call. I got paid for it and still kept my money.
Yes.
Okay. Does the idea of zero-sum imply anything about zero expected gain of the security?
No. Now, you can have one party can have a positive expected return, and the other party, though, has to have an equally negative expected return. This is a paradox about options, actually.
Why would they trade the security?
I'll give an example. If you buy a call option, I'm going to argue that some call options are similar to borrowing 90%, putting up 10% yourself, and then buying a stock or buying a stock market index. Well, if that stock market index has a higher expected return than the riskless return, that levered position will have a higher expected return the more levered it is. I don't know if you understand that. If you have a security that has a higher expected return than the riskless return, you can increase the expected return of your position by borrowing at the riskless rate and buying more of that security. If you don't understand that, you need to go back and take introductory finance. That difference, the expected return difference between the asset and the riskless return, can be magnified. And similarly, if you shorted it, it would be the opposite. You'd be driving yourself to very negative. So buying a call option, since it will turn out to be very much like borrowing a lot of money and buying the underlying asset, often involves huge expected returns, 100% expected return. But that doesn't make it a good investment. And just because selling it is a negative 100% expected return doesn't make it a bad investment. I was at a conference a while back, and the first speaker got up and said, I've got two quiz questions for you. And he put this question down about what the expected return of a put option was. Everybody except me said the expected return, there were 50 people there, but of course I knew more about options than they did. They all said the expected return was positive. After all, expected returns of investments usually are positive. And I said, no, no, expected return's negative. And I won a little bottle of champagne. And also, then he had a call option, and most of the people said the expected returns were like 10 or 20%, when in fact the expected return was 70%. I didn't get the one, because someone actually guessed 70%. I didn't calculate fast enough, and I guessed 40%. Now, it would have been fun to have actually been the winner of both of them. That would have been total, but I didn't pull that off. You want to think about why it's reasonable to buy and sell options in those situations, and why if the expected return is 100%, for instance, and you can easily get that on a call option, and I'll tell you how to calculate that later in the course, why don't you just put all your money in call options, for heaven's sake, and get such a huge expected return? The other side is risk. Huge risk is involved in that same position. The trick to thinking about this in equilibrium is just study the capital asset pricing model. Okay. Under what circumstances is it reasonable for the expected return of a risky asset to be less than the riskless return in the capital asset pricing model?
When it's negatively correlated with the
market. That's because that security pays off a lot of money when the market does badly, when people are poor, and they value dollars more in that situation. So say contingent prices are higher for those situations. If the expected return is less than the riskless rate, that can be justified by this negative correlation with the market. And in fact, you can see that's why if a long position has a positive expected return, a short position must have a negative expected return. Why would anyone short? Well, how could that make sense in equilibrium? It makes sense in equilibrium because the negative expected return goes with a situation where you get a big payoff when things go bad, and you're willing to give up expected return to get payoffs in situations when things go down. And that's why the expected return of a short position can be negative.